cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Okay, so we are definitely awash in AI conversations, the narrative, the market moves related to such, like this year's mega outperformance by NVIDIA, although pulling back a little bit today. In keeping with that, earlier on Bloomberg TV, I think overnight actually, Cathie Wood talking about what will be the next to ride on the artificial intelligence frenzy driven by NVIDIA.
We think this is a very large market, we believe right now the hardware side of it is probably in the $30, $40 billion range. So multiply that by eight, we see the software side going to eight times that. But over the next, between now and 2030, we think artificial intelligence is going to add more value than any of our other technology platforms.
All right, that of course is Cathie Wood of ARK Invest, really defending, because she's been under a lot of criticism, Matt, for her selling of NVIDIA back in January, which we know has been on a tear this year.
It's basically tripled since then. So she continues to say like valuations were too high and trying to kind of justify the sale. Well, I think she should just say we screwed up. You know, mea culpa. We would have preferred to make money with that stock. We didn't. You win some, you lose some. Let's move on.
Well, but
the software part of the story is really interesting, I think.
I agree.
The only problem is her track record for exaggerating with her forecasts. She's like the boy who cried 10,000 wolves, you know? I mean, she says Tesla is going to be worth 2,000. By the way, Tesla's trading at the same PE, forward PE, as NVIDIA. So
okay.
She thinks that was overvalued.
The only thing I will say is she was out early when it comes to Tesla, a name that nobody wanted to back, and she wasn't wrong about that. And so maybe her numbers or her peaks maybe don't exactly mesh with the reality, but a lot of the trends that
Bitcoin,
she talks about.
Like 1.3 million, I
Moderna,
think is her target.
There's a lot of plays that have, and there are other companies that have mimicked her in terms of the innovation play. I'm just going to put that out.
Well, just take a look
at the other side.
The performance of the fund.
Okay.
It's very bad.
But take it back to the beginning. Yeah. Okay. All right. We're going to continue this. In the meantime, we want to talk about one of the most read stories on the Bloomberg. Yes, folks, we're going to get to a point here because it's about hedge funds specifically deploying ChatGPT to handle all of the grunt work. So it's got this AI play, no doubt about it. So let's get into this story with Bloomberg News Managing Editor of Technology and Global Cybersecurity, Lynn DeWan. She's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. I hope we didn't freak you out with her.
No, I'm highly amused.
You can do point
laughing through loud. And I'm so glad that I'm not here talking about NVIDIA because I've been talking NVIDIA for the last like week and I'm done with it for now.
All right,
they've reached the $1 trillion mark and now it's done for now.
Well, what's But wait, what is the narrative around that? Is it that it's just too much to right now at this point?
I think that everyone's freaked out over the past week, right? I mean, you've seen huge gains.
Yeah.
You've got to like take a pause and question whether it deserves that. And then Cathie Wood, right? I mean, she's got some valid points. There's going to be more competition in this space. There already is. It's only a matter of time before you see more and more people pile into this like AI market and try to stake their own claim to it. So
it's absolutely true. I mean, the thing about NVIDIA not to bring it up, sorry, Lynn, is that for a long time, I feel like if you called up your broker and said, I need it on AI right now, she probably was like, there's a stock for you. It checks every box, as Kathy Wood said. NVIDIA is it. And that was the only stock. You know, everybody else, even in AI, wasn't doing nearly as well as NVIDIA. But at least the good thing about Kathy Wood's interview on Bloomberg TV is that she points out there are going to be a lot of other beneficiaries. If it's really true, if this is the next wave of innovation, it's not just about the people who make chips, right? There's so much more.
Much broader. It's
Think about the entire AI supply chain. It goes from like the fossil fuels that generate the electricity, that power the data centers, that use the chips. There's an entire chain to make money off of, not just one company or
so. Tie in Wall Street, because you know, the one thing we need to talk about is AI is not a new thing. And we keep bringing like, whoa, look at this new, you know, shiny object. But it's been around for a long time. Generative machine learning, though, does take this all to a different dimension. Talk to us about Wall Street and their embracing of AI and where we are today.
Yeah, so let's talk specifically about generative AI, because that is where we are at right now. That is what's new, right? And when it comes to generative AI, I'm talking about like the AI tools like ChatGPT and DALL-E, where you can give it a prompt like, you know, show me a picture of a rooster that's pink sitting on a brown couch, and it'll be able to do that. So it can like create content on the fly. They're basically using these kinds of generative AI tools for back office work. I mean, you said it well, grunt work, right? So these are the kinds of tasks that you might assign to interns or entry-level workers or admins. Some examples that we gave in our story today were summarizing fund performance, assessing like vast amounts of market research to distill it, writing basic code. Like, these are the very mundane tasks that real junior workers of Wall Street are used to doing.
And they've been doing this for a while. Or no, is this new?
The generative AI part is the new part, okay, right? So Wall Street has been using machine learning for years. I mean, these hedge funds are just as much software companies as they are traders and investors at this
Love
point.
That.
They employ a ton of engineers that just do quant research, just build algorithms. I mean, that's where like quant trading comes from. So really, AI is not new to the space. Generative AI is new to the space. I mean, it's new to everybody. It's new to the world. ChatGPT like changed everything, and now suddenly everyone can program, everyone can use large language models, everyone can write essays.
But Carol, as you point out, it's just one more tool that Microsoft is offering people in the back office, right? When I first started out as an intern at Tucker Anthony, you know, 25 years ago,
little Matt Miller,
I had my introduction to Excel, right? I was using other Microsoft tools. I was, you know, printing out mailers.
But there are tools and there are tools, Matt, that change the world.
Yeah, but this
technologically.
But I think, Lynn, what you're saying is right now, Wall Street is using this just as far as the intern sending out Christmas cards,
it's
right?
New it's Excel, right, that's right. That's
it's not exactly picking right. stocks for anybody yet.
Correct.
But it
correct.
Could, because they, because, and we've talked about this, Matt.
Right? Well, gets, they wrote about it.
It gets smarter and smarter and smarter.
Like that's
the more
right.
Data that goes
I mean,
into it.
It potentially could, and I think that that is the hope of these hedge funds. But the technology isn't perfect. You know, you might have read the stories, but ChatGPT, it lies. Like, it makes stuff up literally, and it spits out a lot of really inconsistent responses, and nobody really knows why, even the people who built these systems. So there's the issue of inconsistency and the fact that it can make up things, but there's also the issue of data leaks, which financial companies are very
concerned about. Weekend I was using ChatGPT to try and determine the best strategy to get my three of a kind in Yahtzee. And it told me one thing, and I questioned the model, and then it told me another. It said,
I drew
the wrong conclusion.
Can we just all have a moment of Matt playing Yahtzee? Okay, now go ahead.
So it's very sweet. My point is, it makes mistakes. On the other hand, in your story that we're kind of focused on right now, Lynn, which is Justina Lee and Sejal Kishan wrote, hedge funds are deploying ChatGPT to handle all the grunt work. They point out that the Fed found OpenAI's ChatGPT does better than Google's BERT in determining whether or not sentences are hawkish or dovish. So it does have real value in terms of investing.
It could have very real value. And Justina and Sejal laid it out very well. I think that they are still trying to figure out where that value lies. I think a part of it isn't even just concerns about the factualness of these tools as much as it is, How do we make it work? How do we use it so that it makes money? So there's that too.
I think the quandary is, like we talk about, it gets smarter and smarter the more data that gets put into it. But at the same point, does that mean you have to open it up to everybody? And that means everybody has your information. And
that I feel like right.
That makes it really
tricky. Open source nature of some of these tools really freaks out Wall Street. They're trying to like build their own in-house tools. Everybody is looking at that, but that's the big concern, right? You just don't know where that information is being stored when you put information in. I don't know where your Yahtzee information is being stored in ChatGPT now.
Here's the thing.
Oh, no.
It could be open to everybody now.
If you're going for three of a kind and you roll twos, do you pick up the other three dice and roll them, or do you pick up all five? Because your chances of rolling three of a kind are like 42%
anyway.
All
I know is this holiday season, when you get that card, happy holidays, Matthew Miller from ABC Brokerage House. It might have been ChatGPT. great stuff. We are all learning as we go in this. Lynn, thanks so much. This was fun.
Thank you.
Lynn DeWan, she's Managing Editor of Technology and Global Cybersecurity at Bloomberg News here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Do you play Scrabble too?
Well, we do play Scrabble, but it was an international crew. So we felt it would be unfair and we chose Yahtzee instead.
Oh my gosh, to be continued.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, right now, though, we want to talk about stuff going on outside the United States, specifically what's going on between Russia and Ukraine. The U.S. and European allies urging caution on whether Ukraine should have the right to strike inside Russia, that amid concerns that a potential escalation could drag them into a broader war. Meantime, you've got President Putin demanding that Russia strengthen air defenses around Moscow after the biggest drone attack on the capital since he ordered the invasion of Ukraine. So let's get the latest and some really thoughtful thinking about what's going on, at least the latest incidents. A valued voice for us on the war is Angela Stemp. She's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a former national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council, also served in the Office of Policy Planning at the U.S. Department of State, and her 2019 book, Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. She joins us once again on the phone from Washington, D.C. Angela, good to check in with you once again. We've been wanting to since those headlines about the drone attack in Moscow specifically. What do you think about what's going on right now, this war that's been going on for more than a year? What do you think is going on inside the mind of President Putin right now?
So President Putin knows that the Ukrainians have said that they're going to launch a counteroffensive anytime soon. They've been saying that for some time, but we believe they will do that. And so he's clearly very concerned about that. Then you had a few weeks ago, a lone drone attack right inside the Kremlin walls. And then yesterday you had these drones that attacked the very posh suburb of Moscow, where all the wealthy people live and where Putin himself has one of his official residences. So he must be wondering what the Ukrainians or their supporters have up their sleeves next. I mean, the Ukrainians have said that they didn't launch the drones yesterday. We do know that there are also saboteurs inside Russia. And just a few days ago, and it's going on now, we had a group of people who identify themselves as anti-Putin Russians march over the border to Belgorod. And today, the Russians are evacuating children from that border town. So it's really to give the Russians a dose of their own medicine and made them uneasy and not know what's coming in the future. But it must make Putin very angry about this. This, remember, was supposed to be a three-day war.
So before we go any further with the drone attacks on the Kremlin, I've got to ask you, Angela, about what everyone says when I talk about this. And that is, well, who did the Nord Stream pipeline attack, right? It doesn't make any sense that the Russians would have sabotaged their own pipeline, but also the U.S. doesn't typically operate that way. It wasn't a fantastic job. So who do you think was behind that?
I mean, who knows? There's so much mystery surrounding all of this. I've seen reports in the press here that some governments think that it was a group of Ukrainians or pro-Ukrainians, not government-sponsored, but if you like, they were freelancing, that they did that. I don't know whether we'll ever know who did it, but I don't really have any good theories. I mean, if you think the Russians did it, the only reason would be to raise, you know, oil and natural gas prices, but that seems a rather roundabout way of doing it. So I think we don't know now.
As you said, we thought this was going to be a three-day war. Here we are, you know, 1 year and counting. So
they thought it was going to be a three-day war.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And I think the world thought that this was going to come to an end much more quickly. Having said that, how do you figure out or how do you think about when this might come to an end and what might ultimately bring it to an end?
Well, at the moment, there really does seem to be no end in sight. I think Putin definitely believes that he can outlast the West, that eventually, we'll have elections in the U.S. next year. There are other European countries that will have elections. And in the end, people will say, we can't go on supporting Ukraine like this. We're dealing with inflation. And so we should really rethink that. So that's what he's waiting for. He's waiting for the West to give up on Ukraine, if you like. And then the Ukrainians won't have all those weapons. And so eventually they won't have any choice but to negotiate with Russia on Russia's terms. Now, so far, we haven't seen that happening. The West is still pretty united.
Pretty united.
15 months into it. Yeah.
I mean, Angela, we're starting to see, especially on the far right, grumblings about why are we funding this war? Or at least, why are we funding the defense of this democratic nation? Do you think that's going to go further? Does it seem like those in, the Freedom Caucus are going to try and take funding away?
Oh, I'm sure that they will. I mean, so far, I think we have very robust congressional support for Ukraine, mostly. But the people in the Freedom Caucus, the people who are supporters of Donald Trump, think that we shouldn't be supporting Ukraine. Some of those people even think that Russia should be our ally, not Ukraine. And I'm sure as we get into the election season for next year, those voices are going to get louder. And the people who still believe in supporting Ukraine are going to have to come up with very convincing arguments.
What about the people of Russia more broadly? Are they still behind him? We know that there are factions, right, of folks that don't support it. But I'm just curious more broadly, especially if, you now see, the drone attack on Moscow. Is that changing sentiment internally?
Well, I think for those people who believe in the government narrative, then, the drones just shows that it's the aggressive West. So The majority of Russians still appear at least to support this war passively because they have been fed this diet of propaganda that the West and the U.S. is out to get them. Then there are groups in Russia who think that Putin isn't being strict enough with this war, that the Russia should be more extreme in the way that it's treating Ukraine. So he gets criticism from the right as well. But so far, there does not seem to be any kind of a groundswell movement in Russia that's anti-war. Don't forget, a million people have already left Russia, many of whom left because they opposed the war.
All right. So in terms of the war on the ground in Ukraine, what are the chances that the Ukrainians can actually make some headway and push the Russians out? Is that even in the cards, or do they need jets and a lot more from the West to do it?
Well, I think people believe that they may be able to push the Russians out of some of the occupied areas in this counteroffensive. But this is only going to be one of what apparently will be a number of different counteroffensives. I don't think anybody thinks for this particular one that will happen soon, that they're going to push the Russians out of everything that they occupied, particularly the territories that they already occupied after 2014.
So how do you think about this? I mean, I think I've talked with you before, writing another book and how you're thinking about, Putin going forward in Russia. I'm not wrong. But so, how are you thinking about this?
Well, I'm still looking into what I think will be a very long war. This could go on for a long time, as long as Ukraine gets weapons from the West, because the Russians will get what they need, even if the army has performed certainly below par. At some point, the Russians might be persuaded that it's in their interest to have a ceasefire. But so far, they've said that they will only do that if Ukraine accepts all their conditions. And as long as Ukraine is fighting back and as long as it's led by Volodymyr Zelensky, they're not going to do that.
Hey, Angela, who watches this the most closely? China, Taiwan? I'm just curious, North Korea? Who do you think is watching this, especially in terms of how the West reacts with Moscow?
Well, clearly China is watching very carefully because it does affect its own view of maybe the timing on what it does to Taiwan. And then I think probably countries like North Korea are watching this too, just to see how this plays out. But I think China is the one for whom this probably has the most resonance.
North Korea. They're watching it on like an old black and white set with rabbit ears.
It's all right. They're watching. They're watching. Angela, always appreciate you Thank weighing you. In on this. Be well. Good to check in with Angela Stent, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Check out her world and her book that's on Putin's world, Russia Against the West and with the Rest, as we said, you know, has served within the U.S. Department of State and the National Intelligence Council. So really has some great vantage point on Putin himself, but just more broadly when it comes to global policy.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, if you checked out the Bloomberg original series, The Future with Hannah Fry, you may have come across an episode that looked into how a scientific revolution has begun, one that may bring the fantasy of immortality a little closer to reality, at least by a few decades anyway. Researchers the world over are closing in on discoveries that may help humans live longer, perhaps well into their 100s. So we have lots of conversations and lots of questions about wellness and living longer and lifespans in general. In the meantime, investors, including Primetime Partners, are finding ways to bet on the world's aging population. So with us in our studio is Abby Miller-Levy. She's co-founder and managing partner of the early stage venture capital firm focused on the $1 trillion global aging sector. There's a lot going on. The firm is Primetime Partners, co-founded, by the way, with longtime venture capitalist Alan Patrickoff. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Come in a little bit so we can hear you, because we want to make sure it's
absolutely.
Talk to us a little bit about the aging space and how you guys think about it as investors, because there is a lot going on, but it could be, you know, housing for people aging. It could be healthcare. So how do you think about it?
Absolutely. There are so many parts of how we think about the longevity sector. And if you think about it this way, if you ask AARP, for example, they do surveys all the time of older adults, and they say, what do you care about? And they care about their health, they care about financial independence, and they care about having meaningful experiences. And so that means basically, in my mind, longevity means all of healthcare, all of retirement and wealth management, all of consumer and media, and as well as housing and real estate. And so it's quite a broad industry. As investors, we're focused on the early stage, and we, Age Tech, as it's now called, had about $2.3 trillion of investments, billion dollars of investments just in 21 and 22. It's really an emerging space. I liken it to where climate tech was 20 years ago. Everybody understood that climate change was, not everyone, there was a widespread, there was a lot of data. Yes, there was a lot of data that said climate change is happening and we need to address it as a society. This seismic shift in our age demographic, this is not new information. The fact that 25% of the U.S. population will be over the age of 65 by 2050, 30% in Japan, this is not new information. The question is, how do we adapt to it? The same way that the climate tech industry and has had to adapt to this new reality. So that's how we really think about it. There's a lot of opportunity, but we have to, in some ways, prompt and nudge and push on the urgency of the topic.
Well, there are a lot of problems then to be solved, right? Because especially if people are retiring at 65, 70, and they've, on the financial side of it, they're ready for maybe another 20 years, possibly 30. But what the data is showing is that they could go for another 50 years, right?
So absolutely.
I guess there are problems that need to be solved in terms of how they finance it. The healthcare bill is going to be off the charts, right? And then for meaningful experiences, what are they going to do?
Absolutely. Well, you know, one of the most pressing problems is that 50% of Americans don't have retirement savings.
That's what I think about. Like, how, if you're living longer, yay.
Yes.
If you don't have the money to support yourself, not so great.
Well, I think there's a few things. One is, you know, our individual choices. You know, average retirement age right now is 62. That hasn't changed much in the past few years. We are going to need to work longer.
Yeah, but that seems incredibly young. 62,
exactly. Then you have 40 more years of yeah, basically asset decumulation versus accumulation. And so that is a major choice we have to make. And also, given ageism in the workplace and things like that, we need to really work on workforce longevity, but also real changes in forcing retirement savings. And so really excited that the government...
How do we do that?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. The Secure Act 2.0 was the first time that by 2025, employers who offer 401ks are going to have auto-enrollment. In other words, instead of saying to someone at 20, hey, would you like to save now?
Just do it.
And there have been studies done by Bank of America that show basically that increases participation by 5x. And so oftentimes in my role as an investor in the space, friends and family always ask me, you know, Abby, what's the secret to longevity? As if I know some secret pill. And by the way, there's a huge biotech industry focus on this. Mm-hmm. I always say, and they're very it's not as sexy an answer, but I say, max out your 401k. That's the secret to longevity. Because if you don't have financial longevity, you will not have a lesser chance of having a decent health span. And we are starting to see that. People in their 20s and 30s right now are investing at higher rates in their 401ks than before. And in fact, one of our portfolio companies is called Penelope. What they do is they allow solopreneurs and micro business owners to offer 401ks at reasonable prices. Because as a small business owner or even a gig economy worker, you should be able to have own 401k as a self-employed person. So we really see that as an opportunity in terms of retirement savings to think about that. The other interesting part of the industry is really going to be around asset decumulation. Most of our financial services sector is focused on accumulation. If you think about decumulation, this is everything from now that you have these 401ks, most people, they're sitting in, first of all, most people have an average of 7 retirement accounts, if you have retirement accounts, because every time you move employers mm-hmm. or are out of work and do a Roth IRA or an IRA, then you have all these accounts, and there are these small sums of money sitting typically in passive investment accounts. So another business we really like is a business called Retirable that basically allows you to put them all together and then look at actually how do we invest or think about even drawing a paycheck from our retirement savings. So you're really thinking about it differently. And also, of course, home equity. You know, the majority of older adults, 87%, have home equity. And so how do you think about that as a bank account and really without the punitive products that may have existed or this, you know, sense of it as only emergency funding, how do you really think about it actively as funding?
You do say early stage that you yes. guys go into. Where are you seeing the most kind of company creation? Is it in the financial products? Is it in how we live? Is it how we experience?
Healthcare.
Is it healthcare?
Yes, it's absolutely in healthcare.
Yeah.
So 2/3 of our investing is in healthcare. And healthcare, you know, is still the largest, you know, one of the largest contributors of our society. And older adults consume 2/3 of all healthcare spend. So there's really incentives on everybody's side. The government that pays for 65% of older Americans' healthcare, the health plans, insurers, and, you know, pharma, everybody is incented to figure out how we take better care of older adults.
So what do you invest in? I'm curious the kind of companies that are come up on your radar and you say, okay, this is something of interest.
Absolutely. You follow the money. And where the money is basically in figuring out how to reduce the cost of care and how to make care more accessible. If I had to bucket it into two buckets. Again, we don't do pharma or biotech, so that's something that's not in our purview.
Right.
But within our purview, it's reducing cost of care. So for example, anything that would prevent an older adult from hospitalization. A hospitalization can cost a health plan anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000. So reducing hospitalizations might be nutrition, might be medication adherence, might be fall prevention, might be even things such as updating your home to make sure that there's safety within the home. So we've invested in several solutions that sell into health plans to say, hey, let's prevent these hospitalizations that have clinical results and data to show we can prevent hospitalizations. So that's one example. On the accessibility front, I mean, I'm sure most of the listeners here recognize that COVID changed everything in terms of telemedicine.
Right.
Telemedicine wasn't was very infrequently a reimbursable experience before COVID, but it was basically built into our healthcare system now as a way to deliver care. So we've invested in many businesses that frankly make telemedicine more accessible from an infrastructure layer, a company called OpenLoop. And then about a third of our investments use telemedicine as a delivery and accessibility mechanism. And we're looking at other businesses, you know, and I know everyone's very focused on AI.
Yes.
You know, within healthcare, what's really interesting is you think about the word care. Healthcare, particularly for older adults, has always been a service business. There's a human involved. And where does AI do a wonderful job? It does a wonderful job of making human interactions faster, easier, more personalized.
We talk about this. I don't know if this is where you're going, and forgive me if I'm like off in a crazy way, but just this whole idea of older people who are lonely,
yes.
and this idea of creating a robot or something that can, I know, Matt, you're looking at me like I'm crazy, but I've seen it firsthand and it's devastating. And whether there can be interactions. I know you're thinking,
I don't think that's crazy. I did a story on that like 20 years ago.
I know.
My thing is, I wonder how high valuations are right now, because I'm sure a lot of people want to get into this space. It's an incredible demographic, right?
Sure.
Well, I just got about 20 seconds, unfortunately.
So robots, we're less excited about. We're excited about technology enabling meetups, live experiences.
Yeah.
It's really human to human. But on valuations, just like everybody else, valuations have come down back to, I'd say, 2019 levels on many companies. But because we invest early stage has largely been protected from the valuation perspective. I think the one thing that has changed is people are focused on profitability and making their money last.
We have to run. Come back soon.
We'll do.
All right. Abby Miller-Levy, she's co-founder and managing partner at Primetime Partners here in studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, in our last segment, we talked about the $1 trillion global aging sector and how investors are tapping into it. One new elder care benefit company in that group, though, is called Papa. It's essentially a gig economy version of Home Assistance, a family on demand task rabbit for seniors that's being offered by some well-known health plans and is embroiled in assault allegations. Bloomberg News technology and venture capital reporter Priya Anand and the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber, join me and Matt Miller with more.
The company is venture-backed. It's a handful of years old. It's been valued by investors, including SoftBank and Tiger Global, at $1.4 billion. Their model is essentially bring the gig economy to elder care. So they have a network of independent contractors who can sign up within minutes, go through a background check process, and get onboarded. And then those folks are sent to the homes of elderly clients who are members of health plans that the company contracts with. The company does a lot of business with Medicare Advantage plans. Some of the country's biggest insurers are customers and clients of Papa. And working with Medicare Advantage, they're essentially taxpayer subsidized.
Well, the thing is, even before I read your story, elder care and child care is the last place I want the gig economy to be. Is everybody for this? It's such a bad idea.
Well, what we found in our investigation, where I reviewed more than 1,000 incident records of complaints that have been filed with the company by members, by its own workforce, the independent contractors who are the pals that they send, that's the term they've given their workers, you send a pal to the home of an elderly member. The company's whole thing is they remove the nursing element from home aid. And so, you know, they send independent contractors with very little training, a short video that they watch for training, into homes. And the way they were able to sell this to insurers is there's a huge shortage of caregivers in this country. But at the same time, in reviewing the more than 1,000 records of complaints that have been filed, it's clear that their contractors are sent into situations that they're unprepared for. And it does lead to some questions around, is the gig economy the right model for a company of this sort, right? And part of the reason why this has been something that insurance companies have signed on board for is that there is this severe shortage of caregivers in the U.S. The Surgeon General has talked about this. You know, people have written extensively about just the lack of caregiver services in America. In this case, the population that this company is serving, Medicare Advantage plans, oftentimes folks are very vulnerable in that population, and cost is also an issue. So when this company, Papa, partners with a health insurance plan, oftentimes the insurance plan will make it available as a service to its members for, you know, X amount of hours a week that they can use this thing for free. And if they don't have any other form of help, they don't have family members who can be caregivers for them and family members who can help them get to the store, to the bank, to do laundry, things like that. The idea is that they would then turn to these contractors through this app.
Right, exactly.
For family on demand, they call it.
We want to bring in the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, Jill Weber. He's here in our studio as well. I do feel like this is the kind of story you guys do so well. It's like very specific and really gets into the details. And it sounds like there's still a lot to figure out about kind of either how to make it work better or where it all went wrong.
Yeah, all Priya and her excellent reporting on this one. You know, to Matt, to your point there of like, who thinks this is a good idea? Well, you know, the company does. And, you know,
the company also picked the name Papa, which is a terrible idea.
It solved that the CEO and founder actually had some personal experience with. Mm-hmm. And so scaling that is totally where this came from. Of course, we are in this massive shortage of workers everywhere. And who needs to spend time with people? Well, like, elderly people need to spend time with people. In theory, this sounds great. It's just sort of one of those realities where the gig economy meets up with something that hasn't totally been kind of proofed in the real world.
Read Priya Anand's full story online or on the Bloomberg Terminal for more details on some of the allegations facing Papa.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I can't believe you can't hear this, Shree.
No, are you not wearing an earpiece? He's not wearing headphones or an earpiece, so he can't hear. But Shree has always hated Alice Cooper.
Do you hate Alice Cooper? School's out forever?
No.
Okay. Anyway, Memorial Day now in the rearview mirror. Many parents are getting ready to send their kids off to summer camp, and our Business Week team out this week with a special digital series on the, what is it, like $3 to $4 billion market for such programs that serve 26 million Americans each year and many years ago, Matt Miller. So let's get into it, because occupying a small but pricey corner in that space is a name very familiar to our audience. We're talking about the head of Goldman Sachs. So let's get into it. Bloomberg News Senior Finance Reporter Shree Natarajan is here in our Interactive Broker studio, along with the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Jill Weber, as we said, both in studio. The story is, as we mentioned, digital, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg Terminal. Jill, can we start, though, big picture? Because it is one of several stories that you guys have online.
Yeah, look, at summer, and a thing that, you know, it's got some nostalgia vibes to it, but it turns out to be this massive industry that, you know, is sort of quiet and nobody really knows about it, is summer camp. And when we started to think about what the summer camp machine looks like, we started to kind of like spool up some stories, and then it just got really fun, and we kept kind of digging around, and then Shree and Max Abelson were like, did you know that the Goldman Sachs CEO owns a summer camp? And we were like,
no.
I did not know that, actually. Like, thanks for sharing that and like, tell me more. And they're like, well, actually, we think he might have maybe bought into more than one. And then it turns out that Matt Miller grew up going to summer camps and he had recommendations, which did not inform the package, but we found out things about our colleagues after the fact that, I'm hoping to learn more.
Wait, did you not go to summer camp?
No, it's not I grew up in Oregon. Oregon's not known for, sleepaway camps.
Well, like, Oregon is summer camp.
It is summer that's camp. True. Yeah, that's right.
But India is just summer all year long.
So we were just mesmerized by how many cool ideas there were. And Rehan Harmanshi on our team led this effort. It turned out to just be really fun. But we couldn't have done it without David Solomon, I think. Right. And Sri, this guy went to summer camp, not unlike Matt. And which summer camp did he go to?
Well, he went to Camp Robin Hood in the lovely town of Freedom, New Hampshire. And it certainly helped him grow into the human being that he's today, made him very successful. He's now the CEO of Goldman Sachs, but it was also the place where he was frequently known as Saul. And when David Solomon became a DJ the first time around, he went with the moniker DJ D-Saul. Unfortunately, that was too kitschy for who he is now, so he rebranded. He's now DJ David Solomon, way more boring. But DJ D-Saul does trace its roots back to Freedom, New Hampshire.
Oh, so he got that name at summer camp. That's pretty cool.
Still the Saul there, right? Part of it. Yeah. The DJ came much later.
I mean, it's pretty clear from Solomon how you get that.
Yeah, I know.
But he wasn't the first person in his family to go to that camp either, right?
Right. His father, his uncle were there before him. Then he went there. Then his daughters went there. So clearly there is a lot of sentimental value to Camp Robin Hood. And this was back in 2004 when he became a co-owner of that camp. This was well known when he became the CEO of Goldman Sachs in 2018. But what was not well known, hopefully much more well known now that the story is out, is last year he expanded his portfolio of summer camp ownership. He bought into another camp which has one for boys, one for girls in Kent, Connecticut, as a part of a consortium of investors. So technically, he kind of has a stake in three different camps now.
What's up with that? What's his interest? I mean, I get it, the first one.
Nostalgia, sentimental value,
is it a good
or
investment?
A savvy financial
move. Is it a good investment?
We spoke to the managing partner at the latest summer camp, and he says it has been incredibly successful in the last year that they've owned it. Remember, this business has had its challenges, had some struggles through COVID, but perhaps in the post-COVID era where the outdoors are far more cherished, you can see why potential investors would be interested in something like this. And as they like to tout, it's a very, very, very big industry. You
know, one of the reasons that I thought it was a great idea to do this package of stories was post-COVID. It's like, you know what you don't want your kids to do? Look at screens anymore. You know where you can go? Get outside. And you know who's ready to capitalize on that? Titans of Wall Street.
It's nutty. It's crazy. Are there other folks on Wall Street that are really into it?
You know, not that we've heard of.
By the way, guys, I don't think it's as crazy. The fact that the three of you didn't go to summer camp is a lot weirder.
So tell us about
than the
it.
Fact that, look, as the story says, 26 million Americans go to summer camp. And it is typically like a legacy thing. The camp I went to, Camp Kewaunee, in Weld, Maine.
You know.
My dad went there. My uncles went there. My nephews go there. Like, it's a normal thing for generations of family members to go to. And it's also normal for it to be a boys' camp or a girls' camp. I went to a boys' camp. There was a girls' camp on the other side of the lake. We would sneak over there sometimes. That was like a fun thing to do.
You never did that.
I just think it's a pretty normal. That's why you have these American comedies that are about the one?
Wet Hot American Summer.
American Summer. Yeah. So
and then 10 years later, they have the reunion.
Yeah.
It's so very what was your nickname?
I didn't have a nickname. I don't think
that's appropriate for the air.
I remember that we had the lodges. I stayed in Deer Lodge the first year, and the second year I stayed at Beaver Lodge, and we would do this was our insignia, you know? And when I went back and when my nephew went there, the kids were doing the same thing. I went and saw where I had written my name on the wall in the lodge, 30 years earlier. It was a really cool traditional experience.
Wait, you go there for a few weeks And then
7 weeks.
You go back 10, summer. 20, 30 years later for reunion events?
Yes. We had our centennial reunion last year, which was really cool.
That's actually normal. I think like the people who go to camp cherish it. Did you notice?
Centennial?
You know what they're willing to do? Send their kids back
to that
camp.
Is that once 100 years?
Yes. So if you had a chance to buy into that camp, would you do it?
100%. Yeah. I would definitely. I would even donate money. I was looking at the website today, and they have a place where you can do that. I thought about it.
Sponsor a camper, maybe?
Sponsor a camper for sure.
So to this try camp has been around for 100 years.
Yeah. And so has the one that David Solomon invested in.
Nope. 99 years.
Very 99 years. Okay. So we got him beat. Camp Kiwani.
So does he ever talk about it, Solomon?
He certainly talked a lot about Camp Robin Hood, and he did. He has spoken publicly about what impact it had while he was growing up. He certainly is very attached to that. I certainly don't know of him talking about his little expansion of his portfolio.
Yeah, the expansion part was what was really interesting. Because if you've done it once, you're just like, you know, and then you know what you want to know? Like, how many more summer camps can I kind of like
I will
add
say
to my
that
portfolio?
Prices have gone up, I think, pretty substantially. So about...
What does it cost for a year?
About
like a
5 years ago or 6 years ago, I wrote a check to sponsor a camper at my camp, at Camp Kiwani. And back then, it was, I think, $5,100. And so today, because of this story...
Pre-inflation.
Yeah. So today, because of this story, I looked at the website again, and now it's $9,600. Only five or 6 years later.
It's a big
jump. The price has almost doubled.
Yeah. Well, David Solomon's Robin Hood, $14,900 for the summer. The one in Connecticut, about $5,200 for 3 weeks.
What do you get when you're a camper, though, for that?
Waffles, go-karting, and a DJ.
Go-karting seems luxurious. I mean, that's extreme.
What did you get?
We had water skiing, which was awesome.
Dehydrated
rifle
eggs.
Range. We did. I was a junior Maine guide, so I went out in the woods for 3 days without any help and survived.
A junior Maine guide.
Giant games of capture the flag that could last days. It was really, really fun.
But were they sending you off into the forest? What?
Days. I mean, it was a huge camp, and you were either... On one side, or you were either in the maroon or the grays. And so you would compete with the others all summer long.
And then you would like hide it for multiple days and they wouldn't be able to find it kind of thing? Wow. Yeah.
All right. I didn't go, but my daughter did do a little bit of camp. But it was like a farm and she was like out in the woods. It was kind of rough. I mean, are these camps posh or how are they?
Look, I've been in this country for 10 years and I still have to say I find America endlessly fascinating.
Well, Matt, was your place posh? Like,
no,
was it like?
No, it wasn't at all.
Was
you
it rustic?
Brought,
sleeping bag?
A locker, and all of your stuff was in the locker. Before camp every year, my mom would take me to the Army-Navy surplus store where we would get like a canteen and a compass and a pocket knife. And you know, wore crappy clothes because you're going on mountain hikes. It wasn't...
Because $14,000 sounds...
Expensive.
Expensive.
But you know,
to be clear, if you're in a camp in Maine... which is a camp in New England, and any camp in New England will be called an idyllic summer camp, and anything that's called idyllic summer camp is automatically posh. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, we did have the king. Well, when I went there, Prince
this is good stuff,
Philip
guys.
Was with me in camp, and so were Julio and Enrique Iglesias. And now Prince Philip is the king of Spain.
Who were more fun? Which one?
They were not in my age group, so I didn't hang out with them directly. But we had, for some reason, kids from Ohio, New Jersey, and Spain.
Yeah. Wait, I was confused for a second. Yeah. Wasn't Prince Philip Queen Elizabeth's husband as well?
No, the King of Spain.
King of Spain.
Oh. King Felipe. He was, at the time, he was just a prince, obviously.
So, you know? So one of the things that we tried to do in this package, though, is like, what you're talking about is this nostalgic American pastime, sleepaway camp. And that has been a very popular thing, especially in New England. But there's another thing that sort of happened, and we tried to talk about this in the package, which is that style of camp has largely, writ large, been kind of displaced by more like day camps or thematic camps.
Like coding, right? Camps, we talked about this. Right?
Space
camp, whatever. So there has been this shift, and along with that has become this nightmare for parents. Because if you're going to put your kid in camp, all these little thematic camps that are out there, you know when they start filling up? Like January,
yeah.
December. So for you to be planning for your July and August, which is basically when you know you don't have school, which means you don't have childcare, you got to be putting down thousands of dollars and reserving those spots months in advance. And so summer camp, as it's gone away from this model that you talk about, as that price tag gets higher, it's also just added to this anxiety for parents about like, where am I putting my kid? What am I supposed to do? And so we have some really great stories in here about just this hot mess that summer camp has become for parents.
You hear it big time in New York, right? It's like, what am I doing with my kid? And like people are talking about it. You're right, months ago, because it's so competitive.
That's interesting, because most of the reaction I expected was panic about enrolling their kids into summer camp. Instead, I got a lot of the reaction was regret, clearly, over the amount that they had to pay to enroll their kids into summer camp.
Right. And with it, on the other side of COVID now, I think it's like, You want to add $1,000 to that fee? It's like, you know, we know that this is a thing that I think parents are craving for their kids, and get them away from those screens.
So you're saying Goldman Sachs made the right investment call again?
I mean, well, you just DSL made the fair right.
Enough. Yeah, I was going to say, this is his own
perhaps trading investment.
We should be very, very, very clear about
it. I am not surprised that he would double down on a space that he knew. Right?
Do you think on the next earnings call, you know, Sheree, you could just slide it in, a little question?
Nope, thank you, though.
Okay.
There's some other ones that I just want to mention here. There's a ketamine camp where you can go.
That's not for the kids, though.
No,
right?
that's for you. You know, you can go
summer camp
have
for
a
adults.
Little retreat.
I would have liked ketamine camp better. At 19.
A little microdose to focus on, you know, empowering your and becoming a better you. And there's some other adult only summer camps. So if you want to go live the youth that you miss, we have all of that carved out. And you
I
can
think
go
that would be
to
awesome. Yeah. I would dig that if I were single.
Look at this for the nostalgic camper. That might be you.
Yeah.
Matt Miller doesn't need a better you version. He already
no,
has
he
a
is that.
He's
but,
pretty amazing.
You know, the big surprise here, big number, $3.5 billion industry.
That's
and it's cabins, canoes, and counselors, and everything else. So have fun with it. Enjoy.
All right. Really good stuff. And great story in terms of David
Meatballs.
Who would have thought?
Meatballs.
What, Meatball Camp?
No, that was the movie with like Bill Murray at summer camp.
Meatballs.
Yeah.
Oh, Matt, you never know where you're going to go. Jill Weber, thank you so much. Editor of Bloomberg Businessweek has not been to camp yet. Sri Natarajan, senior finance reporter at Bloomberg News, has not been to camp. Matt Miller, of course, has been and will probably go back. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Businessweek podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
A lot of businesses making changes in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. We all had a lot of conversations with business leaders about what needed to be done more broadly in recognizing and really leveling the playing field when it comes to the Black community overall. And specifically, I know certainly on Bloomberg, we talked a lot about Black-owned businesses, which brings us to our next guest. LaToya Williams-Belford is executive director at 15% Pledge, joining us on Zoom in New York City. LaToya, great to have you here with Matt and myself. Your founder, Aurora James, after George Floyd, took to Instagram and said, and I take this from your website, okay, here's one thing you can do for us, tagging the world's largest retail brands and asking them for fair Black representation on their shelves, and talking about the Black community, 15% of the population, and that as a result, that we need to represent 15% of the shelf space, the Black community. Tell us a little bit more about the organization and the inroads post-pandemic. And post George Floyd. Yeah.
Thanks for having me, Matt and Carol. We've been doing a lot of work over the last 3 years, you know, as we approach the 3-year anniversary of Mr. Floyd's unfortunate death. At the pledge, at the 15% pledge, we work with a coalition of retailers. We have 29 major retailers who sign multi-year contractual agreements to diversify their shelves and their assortments to the tune of 15% in support of Black entrepreneurs. We have moved over $14 billion in opportunity for Black businesses as we work to close the racial wealth gap. And we've placed over 625 Black businesses onto the shelves of the retailers like Macy's and Sephora, Ulta Beauty, Nordstrom, and the work that we've been doing. So really working to create a more equitable landscape for Black entrepreneurs as we kind of look to right many of the societal wrongs that we all were talking about in 2020 and thinking about how we use corporate partnerships in support of Black businesses, you know, overall thinking about the most equitable economy for us all, because we know that that is beneficial to our society in general.
So
equitable access.
LaToya, I mean, Macy's and Nordstrom's, these are big nationwide stores. 15% of that shelf space is huge. Are they meeting their commitments?
Well, listen, it's a multi-year proposition, right? And that's why we sign no contracts with partners are less than 4 years. And when you look at a Nordstrom, because of the size and the breadth and the depth of their business, they have a 10-year contract with the 15% pledge to get to 15% in the most sustainable way. So it's really a marathon and not a sprint. And it's really about a long-term systems change towards a more equitable and inclusive, you know, business marketplace.
Part of this process post George Floyd has been an education for all of us. I know I've had a lot of conversations with Black colleagues and their experience in this world, and we all thought we were just so much more advanced, and we found out, no, we got a lot of problems out there. Having said that, I am curious, as you tap into Black-owned businesses specifically, how big is the pool? And I ask that because we at Bloomberg have done a ton of stories about the lack of funding and investment that goes into, you know, businesses started by Black entrepreneurs, or they don't have the access to the financial system and the financial infrastructure that so many other white entrepreneurs have. So give me a little education, if you will, or what you have experienced when it comes to that.
So the pool of Black businesses is vast. So in 2019, Black businesses represented 3% of the entrepreneurial landscape. And in 2022, we now represent 9% of the entrepreneurial landscape.
It's a big jump.
At the pledge, we work with over 5,000 businesses very closely to help them to have equitable access, you know, program development, access to capital, and ultimately to be business ready to scale into the ecosystems of those 29 corporate partners and retailers that take the pledge. So 5,000 businesses are, you know, working directly with the pledge, but a 9% overall representation, and that number continues to grow.
So you mentioned a few of the companies that are involved. What about the biggest retailers in the nation? What about getting like a Walmart on board?
Well, that's where we're heading. We're hopeful to be heading that way, Matt. When we think about closing the racial wealth gap and we think about our goal organizationally is $1.4 trillion generated through our work by 2030, we need the partnerships of a Walmart, of a Target, you know, to really kind of maximize opportunity and always for Black business owners. And what I also will add is that, you know, at the pledge, in addition to the 29 partners that sign the multi-year contracts as pledge takers, we have some very robust strategic partnerships with Google, with Citibank, when we think about all the ways and all the collaboration that it's going to take to really see a long-term systems change to drive a more economic, a more inclusive economic landscape.
There's also, LaToya, you know, in a capitalism sense, a real purpose to this, because if everyone works together in the way that you've laid out, we increase the GDP for all of us.
Absolutely. And Matt, that is a fantastic point, because at the core of our business and the DNA of what our founder started 3 years ago is definitely economic justice. It's definitely diversity, equity, and inclusion. But what we know is that when we support Black entrepreneurs who have been historically excluded and systemically excluded, and we really look at their product innovation and their universal appeal, right? Products made by Black founders are not just for Black consumers. There's a whole universal marketplace there for retailers to be able to drive revenue. And ultimately, when we invest in Black businesses, when they have equal and equitable access to partnership, it is a good business strategy. equity is good business is what we know after doing this work for 3 years.
And I just want to say, LaToya, I mean, no offense, I agree with you, but that research has been out there for at least a decade, right? McKinsey, others have said the importance of diversity on boards and in corporations.
Well, but it's just like Marcus Shaw says, you need to let greed overcome your bias.
But if you do, then you would see a lot more going on. What is it when you go to a Walmart or perhaps an Amazon, if you really want to start moving the needle, right? Why haven't they joined on?
Because there just hasn't been understanding, leadership, investment. The data's there, but the proof of concept has been lacking for many reasons, right? Black businesses need support and development and cultivation to be able to show up business ready. So it's not enough to just say, we're going to move forward, we're going to flood our shelves, we're going to find Black businesses, because they won't be successful, right? So there's a whole kind of ecosystem that needs to be in play for this proof of concept that we are proving at the pledge. The data shows it, $14 billion in 3 years, that when Black businesses are supported in the right ways, and when retailers and corporations really understand the journey, the need, the trajectory of Black businesses, because they have been historically and systemically excluded. So they show up needing additional support. And when those two things come together in partnership is when you're able to see the magic and the proof of concept for the data that we all know to be true, but the actual proof of concept is proven.
All right. Well, certainly great to check in with you. And it's great to hear the progress that you guys are making. LaToya Williams, Belfort, she's executive director of 15% Pledge, joining us via Zoom in New York City.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Hey, listen, we wanted to get a little bit more on the property market, and especially when it comes to working from home. We're trying to figure this out, the demise of the office. John Saxon is chief of staff at the real estate development and management firm, and they really specialize in mixed-use properties. We're talking about Howard Hughes, and he joins us on Zoom from New Orleans. John, good to have you here with us. More broadly, you know, there's been so much nervousness about office and office properties coming off the pandemic. Do you think that nervousness is well-founded?
I mean, I think that it depends where you're looking at. So what we're seeing today is the performance of office is really bifurcated. You have the doom and gloom and everything that you're seeing in the news headlines about office, as you just pointed out. But a lot of that's concentrated into some of these coastal states like California. But what we are seeing in our portfolio at the Howard Hughes Corporation, where we have communities concentrated in Houston and in Las Vegas, is we're seeing incredible leasing activity, especially for those high quality Class A assets. You know, we've seen this out-of-state migration of residents and people leaving those coastal states, and they're coming around the Sun Belt. And again, that's where we have our communities. And so, as we see people moving into our communities, tenants are following. These corporate relocations of offices are heading into our communities because they need to follow that talent pool. And you know, even in Summerlin outside of Las Vegas, we're building more office just to meet that demand.
Tell us about your communities, John, because you've got a fascinating business. The name Howard Hughes, I think, often throws people off a little bit because they think of the billionaire recluse.
Aviator.
In Las Vegas, exactly. but you have some really cool communities. Explain them to our listeners.
Yeah, it's a really unique company. And so Howard Hughes, we're a developer of master plan communities. And so we fit in this bucket of a real estate developer, but really the way we think of ourselves are as community builders. And so we take these large swaths of land, think, you know, 10, 20,000 acres, twice the size of Manhattan, and we break it out between residential land and commercial. And so we sell land to home builders, and those home builders sell homes, and that brings residents into the community. And we use the proceeds from the land that we sell to home builders as the equity contribution for our commercial development. So think office and retail, multifamily, you name it. And as we build that, it attracts more residents to come into our community and raises the value of our land. And it creates what we call this virtuous cycle of value creation. And our communities span, you know, 100,000, 200,000 residents. And in order to build something out on this size and the scale, it takes decades. And so we lay out this master plan where we decide where the roads go and where the residential and where the commercial goes to really create this cohesive environment.
So when it comes to working from home or working in the office, if you had to make a bet, where would you put your money?
Again, I think it depends where you're looking at. If you're in California, you know, work from home, probably more likely. Where we're at in Houston, or let's take the Woodlands for example, which is our community just north of the Woodland, just north of Houston. We're seeing a lot of people coming back into the office, and where we're headquarters here in the Woodlands, we have a 600,000 square foot office building. And I can tell you just by looking in the parking garage every day, there's more cars heading in. And I think part of that is the commute time. So the average commute in across the US is right under an hour. And the Woodlands, it's 7 minutes. So people want to get out and they want to go to the office. At least that's what we're seeing, because you're having that collaboration. And you know, when you leave a meeting at an office, you have those one-off conversations. On a Zoom call, you don't really get that. So I think where you're positioned, if you're positioned in a high quality area with those assets and where people want to be, I think, you know, over the long term, you'll start seeing more and more people head back into the office.
You know, I always think about the Lefrak family, right? Who their history of building these developments where you live, work, play, schools, you name it. What do you think is kind of the special sauce of making them really, really work? Because some of them can feel a little bit either overproduced, if you will, and some of them just feel like a normal, natural development and a natural progression. What do you think is key to making them work?
Well, so at the end of the day, what you will be doing in order to be successful as a master plan developer is creating a place where people can have that better quality of life and feel like they have the walkability to go from the restaurant to the office to their home, all in one very quick place. And you can do it in a relatively short amount of time. And that creates that quality of life. So the way we think about it is it's a little bit science. Right. So, you know, thinking about developing the office and selling the land, but there's also an art piece of it. So it's a balancing act. So you're thinking about where that next park is going to go, where that next trail system is going to go, and reserving enough open green space, and even thinking about incorporating education, healthcare facilities so that people can live this live, work, play in one master plan community, and they don't ever have to leave. So if you can do that and prove that you can do it over a long period of time, we think that, you know, you'll be successful in doing that. And that's what we've done here, you know, for decades and decades. And we still have communities that are in their infancy, and we'll incorporate those best practices to get the same result.
Speaking of decades and decades or being in your infancy, John, I want to ask about you and in your career, as well as the chief of staff role there. You're only 29 years old, but you already are extremely successful after a stint at Goldman Sachs and now chief of staff at the Howard Hughes Corporation. What would you say to people starting out in their career who want to get a foothold in finance or in real estate? And as I understand it, real estate wasn't, you know, your first job. So this is something of an evolution for you.
Yeah. I would say the advice, or at least it's worked for me, is to just have this unrelenting work ethic and having focus and having that drive of what you want to do long term. And so when I get asked a question, if I'm talking to one of the students at my alma mater who, you know, is nearing graduation and looking for advice, I mean, it's the secret sauce that's really not so secret. But I think to give a little bit more context, it's also going outside of just the job description, going above and beyond and doing things like creating a tool or a dashboard or improving a process at a company that makes your boss's life easier. That's been pretty successful. I've been able to do that at every company I've been
with. That's what Matt does all the time. He makes his boss's lives easier. Not really.
I heard David Strip said you're one of the best hires he's ever made. So I get that. What about the chief of staff role? That's the kind of thing that we typically hear, you know, in Washington. So what does the chief of staff do at a real estate development company?
Yeah, I get it a lot. Are you political focus? Is it HR? Is it legal? You know, what do you do? And my response is,
yes,
it's none of that, none of the above. But I like to think of my role as kind of being a Swiss Army knife and being that versatile player to work with our CEO and our entire leadership team to go out and help ways and really push the strategic initiative of the company forward. And so at Howard Hughes, we have 8 different regions. We're involved in a lot of different segments and industries. And so, but at the end of the day, we have one mission-driven purpose, right? To make people's lives better and to, you know, enhance community life. And so working strategically and looking at large data sets and creating a compelling narrative that I can go to our CEO and have a message on, you know, that's what drives the value.
We have to jump in because you're running out of time. 10 seconds. Anything that you're seeing on the horizon that says recession to you very quickly? I have to go back to business.
Surprisingly, I think we're seeing a lot of improvement across the board, and we're pretty positive heading out through the rest of 2023.
All right, cool stuff to check in with you. John Saxon, Chief of Staff at Howard Hughes Corporation, joining us via Zoom from New Orleans.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Bloomberg News reporting earlier this year how the fitness sector has roared back after being devastated by the pandemic. Cost pressures, though, and a possible recession could possibly pose a threat. So we thought we'd take a look, Matt, at the industry. And we've got someone who's actually spent more than 20 years managing, owning, and franchising health clubs. Chuck Runyon is co-founder and CEO at Anytime Fitness, a franchisor of gyms, joining us on Zoom from Woodbury, Minnesota. Chuck, also the CEO and co-founder of Self Esteem Brands, which is the owner of Anytime Fitness and also the Bar Method and more. So he's certainly well-versed in this space. Hey, Chuck, nice to have you here with Matt and myself. Talk to us a little bit more about Anytime Fitness, how it all works and the type of growth you've seen, particularly post-pandemic.
Yes, Carol, Matt, thank you for having me from this beautiful day in Minnesota. Excited to be here. My partner and I started Anytime Fitness just over 20 years ago. We started in Minnesota, but today we serve over 5,500 communities in 40 countries around the world. And our goal has always been to make fitness more affordable, more accessible, and more effective. And we utilize technology to do that so members could work out on their schedule, not the gym schedule. And that technology is still in place today. And when you buy a membership at your local club, say in Minnesota, you get to use every club in the network. So we are still infused with technology. And now recently, we've just launched our coaching suite, which is providing people with education, motivation, anytime, anywhere. So whether they're in one of our gyms or studios or wherever in the world they live, we can now reach them, right? Help them be healthier, help them eat better, coach them to a better lifestyle. And so we're very excited and, you know, tremendous growth ahead. We are on a pathway to have 10,000 units by 2030.
So do you have, you know, a lot of people, myself included, have joined gyms and then like they'll go a few times and then never go again. And every, you know, couple of years I'll join another one and do it again, do it all over again. But I wish I could stick with it. How do you motivate someone like that?
It's a great question and something that has been going on in our industry since day one. And, you know, it comes down to a handful of things. First of all, personalization. You know, it really helps with understanding our members, where they're at in their life journey and where they want to get to. And once we do that, we can now not only give them the workout necessary, but give them the coaching, give them the motivation, give them the education that matters to them, and serve them up the type of content that they want to see. And so we're just in this for a series of small wins. If we can help our members just achieve some small wins, some progress along the way, right? When members see progress and experience it, they stick with their membership longer and they reach their fitness goals. When, like you said before, if they don't get that extra help, if they don't feel that level of personalization, they start to drift away, they leave the industry maybe to come back a few years later. So everything we do is about how do we help our members achieve progress, right? Our members' health is at the center of everything we build here.
You guys, though, believe that basically the government, right, should be, what, mandating fitness? Give us
yeah, a little bit. Yeah, let's get to that. That would be good.
Let's get a little bit into how you're thinking about this.
Yeah, well, let's zoom out again from our industry. And, you know, right now, globally, we spend $1 trillion a year on healthcare. And 70% of that spend is preventable based on something we call lifestyle medicine. Lifestyle medicine is proper eating, regular exercise, and better sleep and recovery. And so who better to deliver that than gyms or studios located in communities around the country? And so we were so disappointed that during COVID, health experts and policymakers around the world forced studios and gyms to shut down, which is the exact opposite message we should have, especially as we saw that COVID attacked people with underlying health conditions. They had it the worst. And so now,
to be fair, we didn't quite know how COVID was transmitted or how infectious it was, right? So as we found our way, like, it just made sense to shut it down initially.
I would argue there that there is empirical evidence. There is empirical evidence linking physical activity towards mental health and physical and social well-being. And guess what? Our industry was working with lawmakers to say, we can social distance people inside of our clubs and studios. We can only allow a certain amount of people in at certain times. We were trying to work with them to say, look, fitness is essential. And if it's outside the club or inside a club or studio, the message should be, let's keep people moving. Let's keep them healthy during COVID. Because now what's accelerated is we have issues of mental health. We have issues where people have been inactive. We have issues of loneliness, right? We have issues of weight gain. And right now, cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes and obesity are the number one killer globally.
Yeah, we have a big fat problem in this country, Chuck.
It was a wrong message to send.
So hold on. None of us are disputing these numbers, and no doubt about it. But this whole idea of government mandating fitness and wellness. I'm not saying I disagree.
It's not that they're mandating. He's not saying they should mandate fitness and wellness. He's saying they should consider it essential so that they wouldn't close it down in case of a pandemic.
Yeah, and I would not use the word mandating, but think about this. What health expert have you heard, like, really say, get behind, move more, eat better, sleep better? It was all about, like, avoiding a virus. But our real virus is inactivity, right? At the end of the day, we lose hundreds of thousands of people a year to preventable diseases that if they were just live healthier lifestyles, right, we could not only save money, but save lives. And so that should be the message coming out of COVID, is how do we get people healthier? And there's no better industry to deliver that than our gyms and studios. And so we're trying to educate policymakers and lawmakers to help with that.
I mean, hopefully we'll never get back to a pandemic where we shut down. I hope the government has learned lessons about these draconian procedures. But one thing we can do, Chuck, is encourage kids to be more active. When I was a child, and I'm Carol, I'm sure as well, we had
presidential fitness.
Exactly, President Eisenhower
had to climb
started
ropes,
this thing, and
do sit-ups,
it was like a big
push-ups.
Deal when I was a kid. And I think that kids today, for some reason, in this like snowflake generation, they're allowed to skip gym class because it hurts their feelings. Like, don't we have to change that?
We do. In fact, if you look at most school budgets around the country, FIAD is being cut. And so there is less and less activity in our kids' lives. And technology is also playing a role to have our kids be more sedentary. So we absolutely, with both adults and children, need to create awareness and incentives and policies to shape the health of this country and to shape the health of global health.
Don't you think technology, though, ultimately with a Apple Watch and different things that are kind of getting us to a point where we're more aware of our fitness or lack thereof in just kind of about 25 seconds, real quick?
I think that the opportunity is there. We absolutely can enable technology for more activity, but it's also like having us be sedentary, right? We're sitting and having too much screen time. So it's both a strength.
No, but I'm saying, like, if I got a watch, Matt's got a watch, like, you count your steps. These things are potentially good. We'll continue this conversation at another date.
I'm with you, Chuck.
No, I'm all for wellness and fitness. You know that. Co-founder, CEO of Anytime Fitness, joining us from Minnesota. This is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live on Bloomberg Quick Take every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.